We're here with our guest, Steve Rosen, author of Lost Cincinnati Concert Venues of the 50s and 60s, From the Surf Club to Ludlow Garage. Steve, thanks again for being here.
My pleasure.
It's a terrific, terrific book.
Thank you.
And the lead in there was a cut of Little Richard's I'd Never Heard called I Don't Know What You Got. And it's an appropriate song based on one of the anecdotes you recount in your book.
Right. One of the lost clubs I mentioned, actually spend a fair amount of time introducing people to, was the Flamingo Club in Newport. It right around the time that the British invasion had come into top 40, a lot of the sort of classic rock and roll acts of the late 50s were sort of pushed away from having hits, and they earned their living on the road. Little Richard actually was still quite a road act because he was still quite a fantastic live performer, but he was kind of had an out-of-date sound. However, in 1965, about the time he did definitely play the Flamingo Club, he had just gone into the studio before the start of the tour and recorded this quite hard-edged, soulful song that really caught the mood of the mid-60s gospel-tinged soul music. And Jimi Hendrix, who was a guitarist for hire at that time, didn't even go by the name Jimi Hendrix yet, played the intro, the guitar intro on it. And there's lots of reasons to believe by people who studied Hendrix's career that he then went on tour with Little Richard, and that the Flamingo Club was one of the places that they played together. Even though he wasn't well known, he was already had started to become one heck of a soloist and to like do tricks, you know, like played the strings with his teeth. And they may very well have been playing the song because it was still new and a new sound. And I just think it really holds up well. It's a wonderful song for Little Richard, actually a wonderful introduction to Hendrix. And oh, to have been there and to have seen them do that, wow. I mean, and to what makes the Flamingo Club, a place I never went to, just go way up in esteem in my book.
Yeah, and Hendrix is kind of woven in a couple of spots in the book, but just a quick footnote. For those of you of a later vintage, they will know the Flamingo Club as the Jockey Club in the 80s when it was a very interesting punk club.
Yeah.
And it was in the 600 block of York Street over in Newport and is now, I don't know, either a vacant lot or a something, but
yeah.
Very interesting place. But speaking of Hendrix, so he and Little Richard sort of had a falling out, I guess, over, well, artistic differences. But then there's other stories in your, I mean, the other and probably much better known Jimi Hendrix connection to Cincinnati is he was supposed to be the warm-up for the Monkees at Cincinnati Gardens and bailed.
Yeah, there's even a poster that lists him as starting, being the opening act for the Monkees. And he was booked onto the Monkees tour and did a couple dates. Supposedly the Monkees loved him. The Monkees, they were really into a lot of cutting-edge music, and eventually they had an album and a movie called Head that was pretty cutting-edge itself. But it was just a clash of cultures with the young kids who were coming out to see the Monkees, so he had to split. But, yeah, he didn't make that. His first tour as a headliner in Cincinnati came in, I believe it was early 68, right after Are You Experienced had really come out. And he played at Xavier at the Fieldhouse.
Smith Fieldhouse, yeah.
Yeah, and the promoter was a guy named Gene Barnett, who went on to start Black Dome, largely because he realized he had the connections and this stuff is golden.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too far out in front of us, because I know we've got different music for different aspects of the book, but I also know we're never going to get through the entire book in one show.
We'll just have to have another show.
We'll have to have another show. And I don't want to hijack this whole thing, but you mentioned Black Dome. So maybe we talk a little bit about that for people like me, who until I read the book knew there had been such a place, but I had no idea where it was until I even read the book. So
yeah, it's gone now. I mean, mm-hmm. But right there, sort of where William Howard Taft comes into Vine, and then on the other side would be Calhoun.
So it's near where the Mad Frog is now.
Yeah,
it's somewhere that CVS or the Kroger thing.
I think it's
thing.
Where the CVS is. Yeah. And before that, it was a U Totem Grove.
Right. Well, there was. I came to town in 1980, which was 20 years after the purview of the book, and there was like this kind of empty shell on that one corner of a legendary club that people kept talking about, but I think it was closed at that point. And so I never got to see any of these places, except as a high school boy. I came to town once with a guy I was working for who, it was a clothing store, and we bought clothes from a vendor whose office was in the building where the Playboy Club was. And we went from the Playboy Club, where we had dinner, to the living room, which you talk about in the downtown chapter, where a guy hypnotized me I had black and white saddle shoes on, which is hilarious. And my employer for years and years said, the guy said you had no blood in your feet. So that's my remembrance of the living room, which was kind of a nightclub or a Copacabana type yeah. lounge or something like that. You even have the name of the hypnotist.
I'm trying to find it as we speak, because I thought I actually had a...
It was an
odd
name.
There
is a story about the hypnotist.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And you had a guy who was hypnotized.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there's so much stuff like that. And as we all know, when we got to the Enquirer, we would hear the stories from the earlier or the older guys in the newspaper talking about, because there were a whole lot of 2, 3, 4, 5 martini dinners amongst these people, before they came back to the office for the night and stuff. And then they would head back after the paper was put to bed. So all of those clubs up and down Walnut mainly?
Walnut was really the strip. There were spurs off of that, but that was really the entertainment strip. Yeah. And, living room, it held out until 1970.
Wow.
Trayon Boyer.
Yeah.
Was the hypnotist.
Yeah, and he was toward the end, but he was a big draw because you tell me about him, and the person I interviewed remembers it clearly and even had his photo of it.
Isn't that funny?
And a lot of people bring that up. Mm-hmm. The living room could be eclectic. It was primarily a jazz and comedy club, and really had some big names, and lasted almost 10 years, which is really phenomenal.
And in close proximity to the somewhat scruffier apartment, the apartment?
The apartment, kind of a go-go club. There was Blue Angel. There was quite a few, and really the Playboy Club was right at Walnut and 7th, which is a very, actually, tony, even luxurious by the standards of some of these others. But it was quite a lively place.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
the I don't want to jump around too much, but there's so much to cover. So this Black Dome, again, just to touch base on this, to bring people up to speed on that, essentially, they didn't serve booze. They discouraged smoking, or maybe that had been the Lolo Garage, but they didn't serve booze, and they didn't have enough chairs or tables. But these guys basically took over an empty building, put a stage in it, wired it, and then had, like, the James Gang play. Or there was a band with Peter Rowan and Grisman, both in Earth Opera in it. I mean, unbelievable acts, and they said they would pack, like, Taj Mahal played there. He said that was the place that he knew that his music was resonating with people because he saw 900 people getting into it.
Yeah. Someone had opened it, had remodeled the building and opened it just a few months before Black Dome moved in and tried to make it a sort of Clifton-style beer bar, beer and peanuts on the floor, and people drinking and all that. And it was maybe a block or two, being across Vine Street from UC, made it a little bit too far for kids. The other thing, and someone I interviewed said, this was late 68, early 69. Suddenly, those places weren't as in demand as people who wanted to hear the new hip rock that the new station WBN was playing. And so they moved in. They got this started. It was the same guy who had brought Hendrix into Xavier. He had good relations with the bookers and promoters, and he just had some wonderful acts. I mean, what we call the places, I guess, now are sort of the rock ballrooms. I mean, they were places where you stood or sat on the floor. They were mostly dark, and you listened to the music. I mean, and you got excited about it. It was like the counterculture's version of a symphony hall. I mean, it was just as reverent and experience.
Yeah, and there's so many threads that tie together in your book about that. So, like, after the Black Dome folds, it's like the Lolo Garage jumps in, is there to pick up the slack for another year and a half. And I think we've got to talk about the Lolo Garage, of course, but then, and Jim Tarbell, who most people in Cincinnati know of, and who started Lolo Garage. But to rewind a little bit before that, I want to hear you talk about the Grateful Dead show at Hyde Park. And there's so much good stuff. I know I'm blathering, but one other thing I want to talk about there is Jim Nippenberg, who used to write for The Enquirer. And again, I was a little too young, but I remember the teen magazine section of The Enquirer. I lived for that thing, and it told stories from, like, the other side. And Nippenberg's description of how a rock concert was different, that it was a sensory experience and that the audience was a participant in it. To read that and know that that was in a mainstream newspaper, and really just an incredibly eloquent description of anyone who's been to a show and just really gotten completely lost in it. And to me, all of that comes together. You have Tarbell and Lolo Garage and the ballroom phenomenon you're talking about that came on the heel, the seeds of which were this teen show of the Grateful Dead. So maybe you could regale the listeners with a little bit of that for
okay, and your description of Jim Nippenberg and his writing for the teenager section is just wonderful, because you don't just see someone reporting, you see almost someone transforming. I mean, just awakening to the possibilities of the music, and doing a very good job of describing what he felt at that time. It isn't necessarily something you would have seen normally in mainstream newspapers at the time, because they wouldn't necessarily have people who were affected by the music like that on staff, but you have to give it to the Enquirer for having Knippenberg and giving him the space. And I mean, Jim's the things he covered, the things other people covered who wrote for the teenage section, and the reviews that Jim wrote really hold up. I mean, it's some beautiful writing, and it's essential, certainly essential for me. I mean,
and that leads to one of the other unsung heroes in this book, not unsung, maybe just right up front, is Dale Stevens of the Post, who I think may have been around. I'm not sure when he left there, but I was aware of him. But there's one description of him where he says, the man could not have possibly slept because he went to every event that was going on at every venue in town or something like that, and wrote about it.
And he was also reviewing movies, going to live theater.
Had a
radio show.
I'm getting tired just listening.
I mean, you know, my next book is going to be just a day in the life of Dale Stevens, where I go through it hour by hour. I'm sure I'll get about 500 pages out of it. But, yeah, I mean, he was someone an older generation than Nip, Jim Knippenberg. He started writing in the 50s, was very much a jazz guy. I think he had a collection of 10,000 records. And he really knew that. He was, I think somebody said at his funeral, somebody said he was a hip cat, which is a great 50s term for what he was. Completely open, though, also to rock and roll and to rhythm and blues. Loved, I mean, his reviews of James Brown, he just loved James Brown. And also, if necessary, a very good reporter when he was covering things at Cincinnati Gardens. Like there was a show by Dave Clark Five that sort of descended into anarchy, and then there was a Judy Garland show where she just basically pulled the show halfway out. He got out there and started chasing down people involved to see what happened and when were people getting their money back and stuff. I thought after I was done, well, you know, if they're, I mean, they have murals all over the city now to great Cincinnatians. They really ought to have one to both of them. I mean, for what they did. I mean, it's
Dale Stevens sounds like Cincinnati's answer to Ralph Gleason of San Francisco.
Gleason. Yeah, definitely.
And to the guy who, you know, was a mentor to all the younger folk and not so stodgy. But I think you almost, at the same time, have to give credit to, you know, the editors of both papers to think, you know, this was, somebody was reading this, or this was important to somebody, because I can guarantee you at a news budget meeting, nobody in that room knew what the hell Dale Stevens and Nip were talking about when they came in and said, this is my story, you know,
yeah,
and why it's important and everything else.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know who those people were.
He was a big deal. I mean, I think if for no other reason than he filled up about 40% of the paper each day.
they got their money's worth from Dale. Oh, that's great. Well, do you want to play some music, or do you want to just keep talking?
Can you play Repent While Purchased by Procol Harum?
Sure. Number 8, Bob, on your playlist.
Should I give the little introduction to it, or should I?
No, you should explain why we're going to play that.
Probably right up there with the Dead playing the Teen Center. If I could pick really important early rock shows that made a huge impact, Procol Harum came to Black Dome.
Wow. Okay.
They were supposed to play two shows one night, and for some reason they were held two nights. People lined up down the street for them. There were huge crowds. All the shows sold out. It was talked about. And one of the reasons is because WEBN, which first came on just occasionally in late 67, by early 69, was the rock format was changing Cincinnati. I mean, there's no other word for it. Repent, Walpurgis was the theme song for Michael Xanadu, who's Frank Wood Jr.
Right.
And he would play that to sort of start off his show, his evening show.
Did that morph into Jelly Pudding? Is that where I would have heard it?
That was Jelly Pudding.
Okay. Yeah, that was. Yeah.
Mary DeSicchio, now I forget her stage name.
Mary Peel.
Mary Peel, the real Mary Peel by that point. Oh, that's hilarious. But you're right. I mean, there's so many things. I knew that song. But so this would have been after, you're saying it was in 69 that this show took place?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was their first time.
In town.
In town.
Okay.
And it was just, it was an event like no other at that time, certainly for the rock ball, because this was the first rock ballroom, and Ludlow Garage was still a couple months away, and it was just a huge.
That's great. Well, you'll recognize this when we play it, and here we go. It's Repent, Walpurgis, Procol Harum from their self-titled first album from 1967. Thank you.
Wow. There's some pretty heavy-duty organ on that one. I feel like I've been to church.
R.I.P. Gary Brooker there. But that's a great story. And again, as I was putting this together, I knew that theme song, but I did not know the name of the tune. But I've heard the song how many times. It's great.
And anyone who was old enough to listen to Jelly Pudding probably just got whatever the opposite of PTSD is.
Well, or the contact, you know, the oral contact high.
There you go.
That. So let's,
speaking
just
of contact high.
Just a quick, we've heard from the far-flung correspondents, our good friend Ray Couch from Bridgetown. Remember about 3 years ago, I told you I saw Little Richard at the Flamingo Club. Hendrix went by Jimmy James. I have to get this book.
Wow.
And there's that. And then our new friend, Susie Sneerney, Procol Harum and Great agree to another session with local music. So our friend, for those of you just tuning in through everything that's gone on in the past hour and 18 minutes, our guest tonight is Steve Rosen, our former newspaper colleague, which all of a sudden the newspapers play a fascinating part of the story of his book, Lost Cincinnati Concert Venues of the 50s and 60s, from the Surf Club to Ludlow Garage and every street in the city and across the river in between here.
And speaking of newspapers, I took advantage of the church-like music to find a bit of an epilogue to the story Bill was talking about before the music, and we were all talking about Dale Stevens at the Post and Jim Nippenberg at the Enquirer and how, you know, really cutting edge they were for the time and open to new music. And Bill made the observation that, you know, it's pretty, you got to give some credit to the powers that be at those newspapers that they would basically let folks write about stuff they had no idea was what was really going on. But before we get too laudatory for the
powers that be,
the powers that be in your book, Steve, this I literally laughed out loud after the first Beatles concert at Cincinnati Garden, which, you know, was whatever 20 minutes long with screaming teenagers, whatever you'd see on Ed Sullivan. The Enquirer has, I'm going to read your own words because you set it up so wonderfully. You say, the influential newspaper, The Enquirer, ran a front page story with a headline so hilariously square that it has acquired its own following. Teenagers revel in madness. Young fans drop veneer of civilization for Beatles. Now, we can debate whether they were going for humor or not, but the Dayton Daily News definitely was, with their headline, Cincy intact despite the Beatles.
So 64, how old were you?
I would have been
13, 14.
Yeah, 13.
Okay,
and
right
14.
In yeah. That age. And were you reading the paper routinely?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was reading the Enquirer on Sunday. My parents got the Post,
mm-hmm.
and so I had started reading Dale Stevens at some point. It was just interesting. I mean, and plus the guy was talking about movies and rock and roll. The jazz, maybe I didn't was a little young for that, but, you know, he occasionally would just pick up on whatever act that was playing and say something about him.
Yeah. And Bob, you had the, as you've mentioned many times, you had the advantage of having older siblings that were pointing you down the right path.
Well, I did. I had one brother who was 15 years older, and he brought the Johnny Cash and Ray Charles and Johnny Horton into the house. And, in fact, told me a story. I think he saw Ray Charles at the Carousel or something in Reading? Someplace in Reading, and apparently a fight broke out, and Ray didn't know it because he couldn't see, and kept playing while people were getting pretty rambunctious.
Huh.
But then my the brother closer to me was 9 years older than I, and he was the one bringing, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Who and the Allman Brothers and the Burrito Brothers into the house. So I was a beneficiary of a broad musical education without any That's idea great. That anything had a name to it, like that this was one kind of music and this was another kind. So I was lucky that way. And that's so, great. Again, maybe that accounts for my just sheer joy in reading your book.
On that. Oh, well, thank you. And you're absolutely right. Wherever there were musicians making music and trying to earn a living off of it by touring, Cincinnati was a place to come to. Maybe not on every single tour, but they would try to come often. And there were a lot of different places where they could play, sometimes very well known, like Cincinnati Gardens, sometimes clubs that might have just lasted briefly or lasted longer, but it's just hard to track. But
or were a basement in somebody's house or something. I mean, I don't know if it was somebody's house, but there are apparently a lot of basement clubs that you ran across over the years. So in addition to praising newspaper editors for just getting the hell out of the way, there must have been, you know, even pre-Tarbell, which is late 60s, a bunch of entrepreneurial, whether they love music or not, whether they saw the ability to make a buck from whatever. Bob mentioned the Carousel, Ray Charles at the Carousel. I remember the Carousel must have been like a supper clubby kind of, had a couple rooms or something like that.
I was not aware of NAMAX playing there, but it was one of the places that had live music and frequently jazz up and down Reading Road, going from sort of South Avondale out, in this case, to
almost
really
to
just
Reading.
The Reading border.
Right.
Yeah, and there were certainly a number in the Roselawn area, and I think you could say Carousel is right on the
Yeah, oh, I think so, that. Too. I think you're exactly right.
But there was Stein's Hideaway was another very popular one.
Well, again, after having drawn a comparison between Dale Stevens and Ralph Gleason, you know, I'll go out on a limb here, and one of my favorite movies of all time is the documentary Standing in the Shadows of Motown, where it talks about these great jazz players at night coming to the Motown studio during the day. So with King Records and whatever other recording was going on in Cincinnati, there was certainly some kind of large group of great musicians living in town that musicians play music, whether it's, you know, recording studios by day or nightclubs or basements or whatever at night.
Yeah, absolutely. There's even the case, there was a club in Newport called the Sportsman's Club. It was a betting place, and it also had live music. There was a case where a singer named Charles Brown, who had a number of just huge hits in the early 50s with a kind of a piano-based blues, and by the late 50s was not in a good place financially. He wound up playing there, indebted to the owner. It was Frank Screw Andrews, sort of a...
Which, a great picture in the book, by the way, by Fred Straub.
Yeah, by Fred Straub, yeah. Yeah, great. Of a post reporter getting
right.
clocked.
Yeah. Yeah. Clocked.
And he wound up kind of being a prisoner.
Like an indentured servant.
Yeah, almost of the place. Because he owed too much money to leave, and so he was kind of working it off by being the house musician. He eventually did sneak out when the place was busted.
A terrific story.
Yeah. And never saw him again, yeah.
Well, you read right there that the FBI comes in,
yeah,
in the black because all of a sudden now, I guess Bobby Kennedy or somebody is going after gambling, mob gambling, and so now they're cracking down. And one of the FBI agents was an African-American, and he cornered Charles Brown and said, "You need to get out of here," basically. And that was his escape. He actually, incidental to the bust, was like liberated, I guess, by the FBI.
Yeah, that's right. And the agent says in his self-published memoir that he says, "I was somewhat surprised," because he was staking the place out, "I was somewhat surprised to see Charles Brown, a man who I thought was quite a star because he had a number of hits, just playing at this club every night, I mean, almost as a warm-up act." And he said, and it kind of like developed as I sort of looked around, that he wasn't able to leave if he wanted to. So I said, "Here's your chance. This place is going to be busted." And he got out. He did, while he was at Sportsman's Club, record a song for King, "Please Come Home for Christmas," which has just become a classic.
That's a great story, too, about that. Everybody, you know, and their brother up into Bob Dylan, you know, covering that song.
Yeah.
And again, each one of these things, now I see why it took you 2 years to do this book instead of the projected 4 months, is that each story leads into yet another rabbit hole, and this is one of those things we waited a few years too late. If we could have had Dick Mackey and Terry Flynn here to explain the ins and outs of Newport back in the 50s and 60s.
We'd have to do a telethon to get all of those stories.
But we're lucky enough to have heard those stories, you know, just overheard them in the newsroom over the years. So, I mean, this obviously a labor of love about the music and stuff, but the almost, you know, tangential stories that go along with this. I mean, I would have loved to have heard Fred Straub saying, "I was just standing there and Screw came out and clucked the post photographer," and things like that. So it's extra special. I mean, I think everybody would like the book. Anybody who of an age, even those not of an age. But for those of us who recognize some of the names of the people, as I've said, I didn't come here until 1980, so this is way past. I don't know the Black Dome from the Ludlow Garage, but...
But you went to the garage.
I did go to the garage and to the living room and to the... I don't want to jump all the way to the end of the book, but, you know, we can get that out of the way now if you want to. The closing event of Crosley Field in the spring of 1970.
Yeah.
And how that came about, the eclectic lineup of it, and, you know, the day long.
All I'll say is I think you could win some bar bets if you told somebody that Iggy Pop played Crosley Field.
I'll tell you what you could win is if you held up the picture of him sort of crowd surfing and with the finger out. I mean, I think a lot of people know that photo, but you could sure win bets if you said this was taken at Crosley Field, Cincinnati, 1970.
Yeah, it's like an iconic photo.
Yeah, it really is.
In fact, I got to be honest, until I read this book, I didn't know that picture was from Crosley Field.
Yeah.
I've seen that picture before. Anytime you read anything about Iggy Pop, but then anything other than what he's doing right now, and they go back in time, you see this picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's mind blowing.
Yeah, and it really is. And I mean, we all know Iggy Pop is this sort of masterful live performer, just someone who can just mesmerize the crowd. He wasn't really even that well known in 1970. He was more known here because he came out of Detroit and there was a lot of spillover. A lot of Detroit acts came to Cincinnati to play. But to see that even then, someone who you would still call a developing artist, mm-hmm. maybe even a fringe artist, could have that kind of command of a large crowd in a large place like that and just instantly find them, you know, figure out what it would take to just hypnotize them. I mean, use that word. And he could already do it. And that was on, there was a television special made from that fest. They were filming it for a special. And the people who were producing the show and filming it, they didn't know particularly one act from the other, and they certainly didn't know Iggy Pop, and they just watched what happened with him in the crowd and said, that's got to be on the show. I mean,
that's the star of the show. Yeah. There's our own Summer of Soul at that point.
Exactly.
At that point. And it's interesting because, again, I remember going to the Cincinnati Gardens where there was basically a Detroit, I'm not sure if that's in the book or not, but it was, I think the MC5 were there and all these things.
Before this. Yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
And so, as you say, it's a short hop from Detroit to Cincinnati.
Yeah, and both of those shows actually had two Detroit producers just coming into Cincinnati with it. They had people in Cincinnati helping them too. But yeah, it was a lot of the Detroit sound. You know, it kind of came to be not that long afterwards, but the Detroit song came to be seen as unfashionable as rock developed and emerged and became more sort of I want to put air quotes around it, but sophisticated and thoughtful, so it was kind of wound up being dismissed, but then things have turned around again, and you know, we look at just rock and roll for its own sake is pretty great, and you know, punk has influenced that, and new wave, and a lot of that, and now it's back, and these acts, MC5, and
Iggy Pop is a cultural hero.
Yeah, it's a big deal to have seen them early.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely,
and. The book is worth to me just the Crosley Field, the last chapter, even though we've talked now for an hour and a half about the rest of the book. But again, there are just some laugh out loud moments. And again, there was a guy named, and I'm old enough to remember him, Jack Les Cooley, who was an announcer, news person on Channel 5.
Oh, really? Because he was like the second banana on the Today Show with Dave Garraway, right? Or something like that.
He was under contract for a network. But yeah, I don't know why they felt they needed a big name.
He was the
narrator.
Host?
He was a co-host. But
he is sort of like emceeing this broadcast, and I can't claim to have remembered the broadcast at all. This part of it was all new to me, but it made me laugh out loud because and quite rightly, and I'm going to look it up, it says in your book that the broadcast has acquired a cult following, and I can see why, because coat and tie wearing former Today Show announcer named Jack Les Cooley was hired for the occasion. He was then 58 and is now deceased. Well-meaning, but way out of his element. He comes off a bit like Fred Willard's announcer character in Best in Show. That's peanut butter, Les Cooley exclaimed when Pop smeared the suspect's substance on himself. That is just priceless. I mean, it's just...
Well, there were so many of those things where, as you say, you know, quote, the squares run head first into, you know, beatniks, hippies, you know, stoners, punks, you know, proto-punks, whatever. And those moments are fabulous.
And what I did
when somebody has a camera on them.
And again, not having been there and being a little young at that time, I didn't realize there were still some Reds games scheduled after this. I'd always thought...
Well, the Reds had there was a week or two before
the stadium closed.
Yeah, before the stadium closed, and they moved to the new ballpark on the
they
river.
They played games in Crosley Field after.
Okay. I always thought I this was that. After that, you know, Crosley closed the big event. And so, as you point out in your book, it was kind of tense because they wanted to keep people off the grass.
Right.
Which is hysterical.
Yeah, and the guy who was really, like, cracking down on him was Dick Wagner, who...
Yeah.
The general manager.
Yeah, yeah, not to... Right. But yeah. Both was a couple years later was the hero for putting together the big red machine.
Correct.
A couple years yeah. after that was...
I'm not sure
like,
he was ever a hero.
Was
but.
A scapegoat. Yeah, you know. I mean, well,
you know,
was,
yeah,
was a villain.
Exactly.
Satan oh, yeah. incarnate, I believe, is what we refer to him as, but that's another story.
Until the 2022 season.
Right.
But that's a different story.
But that's
story.
Next week's show.
Actually, the last musical event at Crosley was a little later... that season, and Isaac Hayes came through. And,
really? Yeah. Okay, now see, I wasn't aware of that.
It wasn't well no. promoted, it wasn't well attended.
Interesting.
Yeah. Nippenberg went and wrote a very nice review. Yeah.
Now, the other, Bob, I defer to you because you've read the entire book, and so if there's things you want to talk about, go ahead. But since you're looking at your phone right now, I'll ask you this, Steve. That,
we're getting talking the phone about, is lighting up.
I know it is.
People are thrilled with
this. The comparison, you know, the Beatles were here in 64, and there was still some rivalry with the Rolling Stones, and they didn't come. I remember seeing them in Hera Arena in Dayton, and they finally came. And then you said they came back in 89? Is that was that the one at the
Steel
at the ballpark?
Wheels, the riverfront.
At
riverfront.
Riverfront.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And then they came back a couple years later after that. But again, to be able to see, I mean, and again, that's 30 years. Well, no, it's only 20 years, I guess, from 89, 69 to 89, 25 years to what you could see the Rolling Stones or the Beatles in Cincinnati Gardens, for God's sakes, to what the Rolling Stones have become, what the Beatles did not become, mm-hmm. you know, because they quit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But to see what a Rolling Stones stadium tour is at this point.
Well, because the show is such a finely calibrated Swiss watch of news, that's a great segue into the Grateful Dead story, which I think we have to tell.
That's right. We've tiptoed around it long enough.
But I'm going to set it up for Steve to talk about it. But very briefly, for Joel and Sol and our other listeners around the world who may not know their Cincinnati history, there's a fellow named Jim Tarbell, famous promoter, started... And I'll let Steve get into the arc of his career. But I only knew him as like the former owner of the Ludlow Garage and a wannabe and later became city council person. What I did know about him was that he was working on a sword fishing boat when he got the call to run a newly endorsed teen center in the ritzy, straight-laced Hyde Park Mount Lookout at the time, yeah. part of town. And consequently landed the Grateful Dead there for shows during their first tour.
National tour.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about Jim and how that all happened?
Well, you know, everywhere parents were starting to worry about their kids in the late 60s, and especially, I mean, the news was filled with drugs and
sex and rock and roll.
Sex and, yeah. and violence. I mean,
and violence,
protests
absolutely.
Of Vietnam and everything. In that area, Hyde Park, Mount Lookout, I mean, they were worried, too. I mean, they thought, you know, these kids are going to follow. I want them to follow, you know, take over the family business and carry on. I don't want them to drop out and, you know, move to San Francisco. And they figured we'd better find ways that they can have an outlet and not feel alienated. And the idea for the teen center came up. And it had some important people behind it. Tarbell, by strange coincidence, had I mean, always the guy with new ideas for bringing people together. I mean, that's really his whole life and career. Had come up with an idea for a teen center in Hyde Park where he was raised years ago, and somehow somebody got a hold of his name, wrote him a letter, found him. It found its way to him. He was, you know, a cook on a fishing boat off of the coast of Rhode Island, and he came home for it. And they knew they wanted to have a lot of local bands, and they did. And he thought, you know, let's have someone, you know, bigger. First big act he had was Vanilla Fudge. I don't know if how many people remember them, but they were also huge on WEBN at the time, and just huge in general. And that was the one I tried to go to, and I was just, you know, again, standing on the sidewalk going down Hyde Park Square, couldn't get in. And then over Thanksgiving, he got an offer to present the Grateful Dead as they made a swing through the Midwest. Did it. It was a chaotic show because the Dead came late. They took a long time to tune up. They weren't sure if they would do two shows on one night and one show on the next, or two shows on two nights, and so it was a little hard to promote it. However, they got the word out. They were inundated with ticket requests. The deal was if you were a Teen Center member, you could get a ticket first, or if you were from the 45208 zip code, you could do it, but people were requesting it from all over, and the shows were just packed, and the Dead were great. They had Pigpen, and he was playing keyboard. He did a lot of the sort of solo songs and gave him that rhythm and blues edge. But then on the other hand, they had Bob Weir and Garcia playing, and they sort of, and Owsley was there.
mixing up the medicine.
Yeah, mixing up the medicine. So they got to, you know, play some of the things from the first album and Anthem of the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's Tarbell likes to say, I can still hear parents screaming down Hyde Park's, you know, the Hyde Park Square to this day from this outrage, because they looked like
absolutely
the Dead, and really sort of brought out a crowd. But as Jim Nippenberg writes in his review of the show, the music, it was loud, but it was just masterful. I mean, it was just that sort of like exploratory soloing and interplay matched to sometimes old traditional songs, sometimes right. new songs that were just a little cryptic if you weren't experienced. But for people with open minds who went, they were just fascinated by it. And it didn't take the Dead that – they came in on Thanksgiving weekend, which may have either contributed to the crowd or distracted the adults from what was going on. But it didn't take that long to start coming back. I mean
– I think everybody, I mean, again, we're looking at this in retrospect and, you know, with like, oh, wow, kind of deal. But if, you know, we're all of an age that when I start to think about this, I saw the Grateful Dead at what is now Newport Music Hall in Columbus, Ohio in 1970, which is smaller than Bogart's, basically. And, you know, and you think back to that, you know, and like you were saying earlier, the James Gang at like an art theater on High Street in Columbus, my first, you know, when I went to school, I mean, Janis Joplin, and I saw The Who perform Tommy, and I saw The Doors at Vets Memorial and things like that. So every generation has their origin story. about what flipped the switch. You know, our friend Ray Couch saw Little Richard in Newport with Jimi Hendrix playing the guitar.
Flip my stand.
And you know, I'm cursed with not knowing what I've seen until long after I've seen it. But as we were alluding to Jim Nippenberg earlier, and I'm just going to read this real quick passage of that we talked about earlier, because he was at that show. And here's a guy. It's the Grateful Dead's first national tour. This young reporter, you know, who's plugged into what's happening, basically, in editing and writing for the teen section of the Inquirer, goes to this improbable concert. And this is so imagine you're picking up your Inquirer if you're 50 years old or 40 years old or my age, God forbid now, in 1968. And this Nippenberg knew what he was seeing when he saw it. He says, because you can feel the vibration of every drum beat, because your eardrum feels the reverberation of every guitar scream, because every progression on the keyboard rattles your brain, because every swirl of light covers your and the performer's face and captures your eyes, because everyone is so close together and so near the stage, because everyone is lorded over by some huge communal oversoul, you don't watch a Grateful Dead concert, you participate. It is also these very same things which work together to make a great concert and which also help to make rock music one of the most exciting, alive, and ever-explosive fields on the horizon today. Yeah. I mean, that's what was going on.
Yeah, present at the creation. There's no question about it. And knew it. I mean, he was a great resource for me. I think in retrospect, he's a great resource for the city.
Yeah.
I like the idea of statues of these guys at some point. Yeah. So, you know what? And maybe we might not get through all of this. We only have 12 minutes left. If anybody's listening, and we know you are because we're getting texts and emails like crazy, and we really appreciate it. And Steve has promised to come back when the buttons start at the beginning of the show and we get our whole 2 hours worth and we'll get a new playlist. But can you, Bob, cue up? I'd like to at least, as a Walnut Hills High School parent, at least talk about the local kids, the Danny Coxes and stuff like that, and who are basically have done this for... They started in high school, and you've got great stories, and that one picture of these guys is just fantastic. So if you can play his cover of the Badfinger song, right? It's Baby Blue?
Yeah, it's the Dylan song.
Oh, the Dylan song, sorry.
No, but Badfinger's Baby Blue is a great song.
Yeah, you know, again, at that point.
So here we go, Cincinnati and Walnut Hills and Withrow High Schools also.
Oh, that's right, and Withrow High School. He went for his, I mean, again, this is the power of the Grateful Dead showing up in Hyde Park at this point. So
here's Danny Cox, now a big, he's big in Kansas City.
Yep.
Here he is from Cincinnati.
Leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. Yeah. Yonder stands your orphan with his gun. Crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, babe, the saints are coming through. And it's all over now. Baby Blue.
That was Danny Cox, which is a chapter of itself, not necessarily him, but just a lot of the local kids who got caught up in, whether it was the folk scene, the rock and roll scene, or whatever, part of the great book by our guest, Steve Rosen, Lost Concert Venues of Cincinnati from the 50s and 60s. Thanks a million, man, for being here.
Thanks so much.
It's been great. You can catch Steve in person on Monday, May 16th at Joseph Beth in Hyde Park, just down the street from the Hyde Park Teen Club.
It's in the if Rookwood, I'm not mistaken. Maybe he'll lead a field trip over to the side of the old
we'll
teen
get
center.
Tarbell with him, and he can recount the story of getting the Grateful Dead to that point. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we scratched the surface, but barely. I think it's certainly worth, you know, another visit if when you have time to come back.
We'd love to have you.
Oh, absolutely. It's
and
been great.
And dig deeper into
absolutely
it
great.
At yeah. that point. So thank you so much.
But meanwhile, because if we haven't whetted people's appetites enough, they weren't listening, where can they get Lost Cincinnati Concert Venues of the 50s and 60s between now and the next time you're on the show?
They can get it from me. Just go to the website, stephenrosen.net.
That's with a V, Stephen.
Yeah.
StephenRosen.net.
And all the information's there, and there are stores carrying it.
Downbound Books in Northside has it. Shake It Records has it.
Shake It Records is running out of it. I got one of the...
Yeah.
Joseph Beth has it, of course.
Yeah, Roebling Point Books.
Yeah. And I'm sure you can get it on Amazon. And if it's between not getting the book and getting it on Amazon, get it on Amazon. But otherwise, get out of the house and go to one of the local places.
Or just go to my website.
Or go to Steve's website and maybe he gets an extra cut. I don't know how that works. Oh, yes, he's nodding vigorously. So get it from his website, too.
That's great. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Thanks for sticking with us through the ups and downs of the technicals. We think we've got it figured out now. We started off the show today, not celebrating, but marking the 52nd anniversary of the murders at Kent State with the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young version of Ohio. We're going to go out with a solo version from Neil Young himself.
Yeah, this one comes from his The Times release, which came out before the 2020 election, had a lot of topical songs on it, some of his and some of others, but this is a good version. And go to the Spotify and listen and look up Leon Bridges, John Batiste, and Gary Clark's version of this because it's amazing. Steve, did I mention I really like this book?
thank you so very much. And it was a great interview by you guys, and I'm going to call you to – if there's ever a chance to read from my book out loud, I want to call you to do it because you do it beautifully.
Well, thanks, and you're welcome back to the show anytime now. Thanks. It's great to see you too, Steve. It's been too long.
It's really good to see you. It's been quite some time.
All right. Yeah. Take care. We'll be back next week. And as always, until that time, love one another. Good night, everybody.